Joe Biden holds a two-hour press conference and nothing will ever be the same. Plus, Boris on the brink. We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Madeline Maddie Kearns, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brendan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsor this episode is Tommy John. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. If you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, you should be completely delighted and feel a great sense of satisfaction because finally, there's a president of the United States who is blessing and giving a green light to a Russian invasion of Ukraine. Finally, the adults are in charge.
It's, you know, brutal. Joe Biden brings all this foreign policy expertise in, you know. So how to begin unpacking this? No, the United States should not bless Vladimir Putin transgressing against Ukraine. That's a very different question from how far the United States and NATO should go to assist Ukraine or try to dissuade or intimidate Russia into another course of action. But yeah, what the president said during this press conference was utterly insane, which is like, you know, when pressed about what kind of commitments the U.S. is going to make, he basically said, well, nothing if it's just a small incursion, right? Like, it's sort of like he kind of defined what the party foul would be for Vladimir Putin. And immediately you saw a reaction from Kiev of total alarm, especially because he didn't just say it once. He kind of said it twice. He doubled down on it when asked to clarify. He revealed, you know, or not revealed, but sort of emphasized that there were different opinions in the major NATO powers about what to do on this, that Paris and Berlin had other ideas than the United States. It was weak. It was bad. And, you know, it was sort of like he approached it like one of us. He approached it like he was a commentator, just giving his opinion in 1 second, saying, well, I think Putin is going to go in. And then a few minutes later, he probably hasn't decided yet. Like he was acting not like the president of the United States, not like the head of the most powerful military on earth and the commanding seat in NATO. He was acting like a pundit, and was totally inappropriate. The only thing that would make any of that excusable is if Joe Biden was deliberately like telling Ukraine, you know, sue for peace, like, because the cavalry is never coming in to help you. But I don't think he was trying to deliberately send a message. I think he was just, you know, shuffling like a tap dancer who's run out of routine. And it was alarming. It was like seeing that there is no commander in charge.
Yeah, Maddie, this was just very disturbing. And I haven't jumped on all these things, you know, where Biden accidentally calls Kamala Harris president or gets the name of a city's in wrong or loses his train of thought, which happens a lot. We're all subject to those things, especially as we get older. But this seemed to be just the president of the United States just actively, affirmatively not being able to address a major foreign policy crisis in Europe. And he got multiple bites at the apple. So when he says the first thing, like, if it's not a small incursion, that, you know, there's going to be a big price to pay. Then a reporter invites him to clean it up, says, sir, did you just say that a small incursion would be okay? And he kind of scoffed, but then he didn't just say, no, that's not what I meant. He said, no, there'd be these divisions in internal divisions in NATO over a small incursion. And then later on, he's asked about it again. And he comes around and, you know, he's trying to deter this foreign policy act that would have, you know, grave consequences. And he says, oh, but they're going to go in. So yeah. That's kind of the punditry aspect that MBD was talking about. And then repeatedly, you could see the wheels turning and he'd stop and say, well, I shouldn't say this because he's about to reveal some sensitive piece of intelligence or something. So it's just this high wire act that is just it's really, really worrying and should be for everyone. And I'm sure, you know, obviously in the halls of power in Ukraine and the NATO allies, they've alarmed. We saw the tweet from Zelensky having to clarify, no, there's no such thing as a small incursion into my country. But it has to be really disturbing for members of the White House team and the State Department. And they got to know, you know, they got to know this about this guy. And it has to account for at least some of what we've seen in terms of him being so buttoned up and controlled.
Yeah, it's disturbing, certainly. And it's also revealing because it seems as if this was the confidential briefing he was given. And he seemed unable to distinguish what should be off the record and what should be on the record. Of course, the entire art of diplomacy is essentially a performance. It's being able to present things in a way that make you and your country look strong. And this just looked incoherent, rambling, confusing as well. There was a lack of clarity. And then obviously the White House, after the fact, tried to clear some things up. I thought Jim made a really good point on the Morning Jolt, which is that Russia's entire approach with Ukraine since 2014 has been this bit by bit, small acts of aggression that over time obviously amount to full-scale invasion. And that's, again, why it's so dangerous that for right. Biden to say what he said, is because he's basically saying, as long as you don't do something really egregious and obvious, we are potentially not going to take this that seriously. And I'm sure that's music to Putin's ears.
Yeah, as long as you do a version of this that you've done before, that's right. achieved your aims and undermined the West, that's fine. So, Charlie, this just isn't hard. I mean, all I had to say is there'll be grave financial consequences that Russia won't want to bear if they invade. And then stick with that. And sometimes we can be annoyed at how rote politicians are and how rote, especially diplomats are, but there's a reason. And one of the reasons if you wander off script the way Biden did, you can cause serious harm.
There's a difference between being a candidate and being an elected official, and especially being the president. And this is a difference that two presidents in a row now have often failed to respect. I'm sure we'll talk more about what else Joe Biden said at his press conference, but these comments were of a piece with much of the rest. He is not expected, he is obliged to answer the question that he was asked by saying, Russia must not do this. I think Michael put it perfectly. He answered the question as if he were being asked it analytically, as if he were being asked it on a Sunday show in a predictive sense. But he's not. He's the commander in chief. And he is obliged, I'll use the word again, to say Russia must not invade. That is his job. Now, when one is running for office, one can say, I don't like our foreign policy. I don't like our commitments. I don't like the international law to which we have acquiesced, or what you will, but not as president. And the fact that he did it twice is alarming in much the same way as it was alarming when President Trump used to riff on this. The poor people of Eastern Europe, especially Eastern Europe close to Russia, who've now spent 6 years wondering where American presidents stand. The outrage was more pronounced in places such as Paris and Berlin and Rome, because we hear more about them. But the people who were really terrified by President Trump's approach to NATO and foreign policy in general lived in Poland and Romania and Ukraine. And one of the promises that Joe Biden made was that he would end that he would restore America's place in the world, that he would inspire our allies and restore their confidence in the United States. And what we saw at this press conference was that he is incapable of doing exactly that.
Yeah. So Trump said some really dreadful things about Russia and about Vladimir Putin. I think, what's it? Forget which interview it was where he said, Putin kills people, but we kill people too, you know, so there's this moral equivalence. But I don't think he ever said anything that made it more likely there'd be military conflict with Russia. Caused by Russian aggression. And this was kind of notable. You know, you had this guy who's supposedly a Russian asset in office for 4 years, and Russia didn't do this, I think in part because Trump had a very active madman thing going.
Well, I would just say I agree with that, but I think where people got nervous was when Trump's correct and defensible position on funding for NATO and defense budgets in general started to waver into America shouldn't be involved. Why would we bother?
Oh, yeah. America no, he first. Said he said some alarming things about NATO, no doubt. So MBD, let's get to the substance of this because sure. You are more dovish on this question. So what should we do in your mind, if anything, to deter Russia, and what is going too far in reaction to what Russia might do?
There are a lot of ways to approach this. I mean, you could look at what Russia is doing from two angles. One, what it's doing to Ukraine, and then what it's maybe attempting to do to NATO or the West or to Europe generally. Right. So there's the threat that he's going to reinforce what has already been done in the western part of Ukraine. And he's trying to force the Ukrainian government to fully cooperate with the Minsk II protocol, which was signed after the last minor incursion in 2014, which has like a level of autonomy for Eastern Ukraine, et cetera. And it's about long-term securing Russian access to their naval base at Sevastopol. Okay. But when Biden invited Putin to this kind of summitry event, and very interestingly, Putin wanted this to be directly with the US and almost tried to cut Europe out of it. The list of demands that Moscow gave was absurd. It was basically like, we want to go back to the status quo of 1997 in as far as where NATO assets are positioned. You know, basically move everything out of the nations that have joined NATO since 1997. That's a non-starter. NATO members won't want to put up with that. And for that, I would say it would be worth, if other NATO members are game for it, it would be worth right now moving more material eastward in existing NATO member states to signal that that is just not going to happen. And maybe you jokingly put a proposal that, yeah, let's go back to the troop levels of 1997, where the United States had over 100,000 troops in continental Europe. I don't think Putin would want that. So I do think there's ways to push back. My problem is that when people talk about defending Ukraine's integrity and independence, I just laugh.
Because you don't think it really exists.
Well, it's not that Ukraine exists on paper, but
its independence is
its independence or sovereignty is a joke. I mean, the idea when people define its independence and sovereignty, what they mean is a completely abject dependent on Western Europe and the United States, and one that is insanely vulnerable to Russian manipulation because there's a huge chunk of people, much larger than what you find in the Baltic states. Like in the Baltic states, after the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, you'd find populations of, you know, 10% or less of Russians who had immigrated into those states during the Soviet Union. In Ukraine, it's much higher. And that migration goes before the Soviet Union. And so Russia has so much more potential influence in Ukraine, a native influence in Ukraine. And of course, it's right on their border, right? I'm not conceding them a sphere of influence. I'm just looking at an atlas, right? Like they are, this would be very difficult for the United States to hold on to and protect, and very easy for Russia to subvert. It's very dear to Russian interests and very peripheral to ours. And so what I don't want is, and my fear is, we encourage the Ukrainians to do something crazy like what Saakashvili in Georgia did in 2008. And then they get a lot of people killed very quickly.
I'm sorry, what is that crazy thing?
Georgia basically like got into a shooting war with Russia, thinking that he would have the backing of George W. Bush, which he didn't have, and which Bush tried to make clear to him.
MBD, what is Ukraine getting in a shooting? Does that mean Russia comes in and they resist, or what?
Well, it could be any number of things. It could be, Ukraine aggressively tries to throw out the little green men and retake the territory that Russia tried to annex in 2014, thinking that we will continually back them up as Russia escalates. And I don't think the Western European powers or the United States have an appetite for that, which means we could be encouraging people to start a meat grinder that we don't have the will to stop ourselves. So I am afraid of miscalculation, either by the Ukrainians or even by us or by Putin. I would allow the opportunity. I mean, what I think is actually happening, if I'm going to comment it on it like a pundit, like Joe Biden, I think Putin is making it, putting a ton of pressure on Ukraine. Coercive diplomacy is bullying them. And in effect, he is forcing the West to clarify the amount of commitment we are going to give to Ukraine. And once that is abundantly clear to Ukraine's leaders, they will then make their decision as far as how much they're going to comply with the Minsk protocol or whatever else Putin is demanding. And I just think that is the raw deal of it. It's not an endorsement of what Putin is doing. I mean, he is, coercive diplomacy is part of what Russia does. It's not typically what we do in the West. It's ugly, it's dangerous, and it's bloody. But I don't think it's a danger to NATO. I mean, there's a reason this is happening to a non-NATO country, right? And I just don't believe this kind of Munich mythology that every territorial revision or expansion is inherently unlimited. That once you let the once you let Crimea go, you're suddenly gambling so, Poland with it. That I don't believe.
It just seemed to me that a huge element of this obviously is yanking our chain, and maybe hasn't even decided yet, you know, one way or the other, whether he's going to go, but he's at least, again, put himself kind of front and center. And now he can just see whether he can shake anything loose in terms of concessions he wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And I haven't delved in this into detail in the military aspect of this, but it seems to me we just, like with Taiwan, the bare minimum is enhancing the ability of Ukraine to defend itself with anti-aircraft and anti-missile capabilities that would exact a heavy price if Russia goes in. But let me go exit question to you first, Maddie. Double barrel, no pun intended. Will Putin go into Ukraine again? Yes or no? And if he does, will it be minor to use the president's term, or major?
I think yes, and I think it will be minor since that's been the strategy thus far.
Joey Cook.
I agree with Maddie, and I do think that Joe Biden made it more likely with his press conference.
MBD.
I would have agreed a couple weeks ago, but now I think it may be a major invasion. And
so what does major mean?
I mean, like, several divisions crossing the border, uniformed, crossing the border in multiple places, and possibly a victory parade for Vladimir Putin in a Ukrainian city in the next couple of months. And I think the aim now would be they want Macron and the German chancellor to sign off on whatever the agreement they'll force on Ukraine is next after Minsk 2, whatever Minsk 3 is. I think they're going to try to get European buy-in, and that will actually harm NATO. So I am worried about that.
So I think you got to just say that the bare minimum here, as Maddie and Charlie say, is yes, and a minor. I mean, how could he not? He's an idiot not to do minor now. You know, if he had any doubt that NATO is going to be divided about it, it's all out right in the open. So I still have a hard time seeing him doing what Michael outlines. It's certainly possible. It just seems a level of risk is really high. And it would, you know, take your point, MBD, about, you know, just because they grabbed Crimea, which I think was really bad, doesn't mean that the whole European order is going to fall apart. But having that sort of frank use of military force, I do think, you know, trespass is a norm that could have, you know, really bad consequences down the line. With that, let's pause and hear from our sponsor this episode, Tommy John. This year, Valentine's gifts are as easy as a kiss. Keep it simply soft. Get it? Keep it simply soft with new loungewear, pajamas, and underwear from Tommy John. When you and your favorite person are wearing Tommy John, you're that much more comfortable, so you can do everything better. That's why Tommy John doesn't just have customers. They have fanatics. 98% of men and women love Valentine's gifts from Tommy John. Tommy John loungewear makes you feel perfectly at ease every time you wear it with soft tri-blend and micro modal fabrics with four-way stretch. You'll feel the love all year long. With over 17 million pairs sold, Tommy John's made couples across the country comfier than ever. Let them do the same for you and your Valentine. Plus, there's no risk. Every gift is backed by Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order right now at TommyJohn.com/editors. Go to TommyJohn.com/editors for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/editors. See the site for details, and please check it out. So, Charlie Cook, another astonishing aspect of the Biden press conference was his saying, quite frankly, that the 2022 election might be illegitimate. This is a new tack for Democrats. They had been warning that 2024 could be stolen if Trump runs again and you have Trump-friendly Republican officials and various positions of influence regarding counting the vote. But now, apparently, 2022 is at risk as well. And of course, this is just jaw-dropping, given even before what he did and the post-election had happened, when Trump just said, you know, I might not accept the result. Everyone's hair was on fire, justifiably. But here the Democrats go, you know, doing exactly the same thing. You could tell there's at least some embarrassment because Jen Psaki denied he said it and directly contradicted him. At the same time, Kamala Harris, with her shrewd touch as ever, double down on what Biden said. What do you make of it?
Well, I would slightly push back against the idea that this is a new tack, in that the scale of Trump's lie has pushed the Democrats into outrage that anyone could ever suggest that an election might be stolen, and forced them and many of us to forget that a lot of Democrats sounded like Biden at this press conference before 2020. Now, this is in no way to equivocate, and it's in no way to forgive what the president did, which was unique and unprecedented. But it wasn't new. Stacey Abrams said that the election in 2018 in Georgia was illegitimate. She refused to concede. She even paused what the word concession meant. And in the lead up to 2020, Democrats were setting the stage for a complaint about the legitimacy of the election. If you remember, there was that whole conspiracy theory about the role of the post office.
I remember that well. There was like a two-day period when I had to really get up on post office policy and practice. Yeah.
And a number of Democrats who predicted that Trump would use COVID to cancel the election. And of course, on cue, Trump then mooted that himself. There were a number of Democrats who proposed that Trump intended to steal the election if he won it. And they were right, of course. Trump did behave disgracefully. But this is not something that has come out of the ether. And it is not the case that the Democratic Party has been pure in this way. It is not. And Joe Biden is channeling that. The proximate cause of that, of course, is his desire to pass his voting rights bills. And I think this just shows how irrationally and counterproductively het up about this issue the party has become. The Democrats have allowed themselves to believe that if their bills are not signed by President Biden, Americans won't be able to vote. There's no evidence for this. The vast majority of the changes, for whatever reason they were made, that have been made since last year, were designed to roll back some of the expansive rules that were the direct and limited product of the pandemic. But in the Democrats' telling, this is the 1910s once again. We are back in Jim Crow. We're not, but the logic of the party's rhetoric has pushed them to this point. And that is why, when asked the question about legitimacy, Biden said what he said, because he can't very well say, well, yes, of course, the election will be legitimate, but also we need to blow up the Senate to change the voting rules. And in fact, when yesterday Jen Psaki said, he didn't say that. He wasn't implying that. He was saying that they were legitimate. When she was directly asked about it and she said, yes, the 2022 elections will be legitimate, she, of course, undermined the rationale for a lot of what Democrats have done in the last week. Not the rationale for the bills themselves. One can argue for those either way. But the idea that this is the defining issue of our time, the idea that this is worth breaking the Senate rules to achieve, the idea that those who oppose it are equivalent to Bull Connor and Jefferson Davis. And I think when the Democrats look back on this whole area, they're going to regret a lot of it because they let their emotions and their passion and their fanaticism get the better of them. And in so doing, not only provoked a reaction that they probably wished they had not, but undermined one of the things they hope to use to make the case for their party staying in power, which is that Republicans can't be trusted because they spread lies about our electoral system.
Yes, I wasn't meaning to imply they hadn't done this before. They obviously did it in 18 and 20, just they hadn't focused on 2022. Focus had been on 2024 at this point. But
right.
Maddie, I think Charlie is absolutely right. This is a party leading itself into a rabbit hole because Biden made the mistake of actually logically following through on the premise. So if you really think that these various changes in Georgia and Texas and other places are the institution of a new regime of Jim Crow, yeah, the 2022 elections aren't going to be legitimate. They shouldn't be honored. There should be mass protests in the streets. So they worked themselves up on the basis of this myth and lie into a proposition that would deeply undermine the legitimacy of our elections. And it's, you know, Jen Psaki and others who aren't following through on the logic and taking it to the premise, because to the logical conclusion, because the conclusion is self-evidently absurd.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think as well, I'm often reminded listening to Biden, how he was supposed to be the president who was going to bring back normalcy. He was supposed to be the president who was going to bring unity. And I think a lot of people voted for him thinking of the Obama-Biden era. And for all his many, many faults, Obama did a good job in his rhetoric of signaling unity. Of course, he certainly didn't do that in practice. And it's just strange to hear Biden talk in the same hyper-partisan and anti-democratic way that Trump did. And it's strange to see Biden performing the excesses that Trump did. And this is just really, really bad for the country, but also, as you point out, really bad for the Democratic Party, because I think most people who aren't in the activist base and fringe of the party can see that for what it is. And it's a really strange turn, and I'm not sure how it serves their interests.
So NBD, speaking of not serving their own interests, so we had this ridiculous tactic of forcing these votes, which we've talked about a lot the last 2 weeks. And what we predicted happened precisely. A couple of us thought they'd actually get fewer than 48 votes for changing the filibuster. But it was a path of guaranteed futility. Futility is what they got. They opened Sinema and Manchin up to just massive amounts of abuse for no good reason. You had one House Democrat accusing, not by name, but accusing Sinema and Manchin of being white nationalists, using protecting the filibuster to block these voting bills. And now, you know, 2 weeks after this idiocy, they're saying, well, most senators, Democrat senators are being quoted anonymously in stories. Well, let's try to do stuff that's achievable now, which would have been a, you know, great idea from the beginning. Because what they did in the cause of supposedly ginning up their base is fail and potentially, you know, drive down Biden's approval ratings even further because there was another high profile failure. And then congratulating themselves for giving it a try.
Yeah, the only explanation I can think of is that somehow Schumer thinks this helps protect him from a possible primary challenge by going after Sinema and Manchin in this totally futile way. We've seen this in the Republican Party, where futile gesture politics of the kind, say, Ted Cruz practiced on the debt ceiling, end up hurting their party at large without but redound to the interest of the person who instigated it. That's one way to explain it. But for the Democratic Party itself, I mean, this is looking like a Democratic death wish, right? This is an issue that maybe 15% of the Democrats, when polled, say is a priority for them. This is not a hill to die on for voting rights. I mean, Democratic voters don't care about it. They can't point to a single person who was denied their right to vote in any recent election. It confuses their message, right? Because obviously you're saying simultaneously that the 2020 election was the fairest election that ever happened, the most secure, beautiful, you know, like effulgent of daffodils election that ever happened. But the next one that we'll have in America could easily be illegitimate. That's a confusing message for voters. And voters don't care about it. What voters care about are ending the pandemic and getting inflation under control. and getting the economy running again in a normal way. And they're just wasting time on federalizing elections or kind of in this elaborated mourning process over Build Back Better. The case for passing that is diminishing every day as well, even among Democrats. So I don't know. This is a very poorly run Senate Democratic conference, and it would be better if Schumer were not doing this job in the future if you're a Democrat.
Yeah, so Charlie, you hammered Schumer the other day, and if this is the motivation that he's worried about AOC, what an appallingly selfish move. And I don't even think that if that's what he's worried about, this helps. You know, why is failing, trying this and failing, going to be a great bragging point if AOC challenges him from the left?
I do think that that's part of his motivation, and I think this is a problem for the Democrats because his interests and the party's broader interests are to some extent out of line. I also think he's not especially good at being Senate Majority Leader. He's not a bad politician in New York. He seems to be able to navigate the various interests well, which is why he survived for so long. But he's a poor majority leader. And I don't just mean that strategically. He's poor practically. If you talk to people on both sides of the aisle in the Senate, I'm not talking about senators here, but staff and legislative assistants, they will point to his poor floor management, for example. They will point to his tendency to overpromise. They will point to his bloody-mindedness. That bloody-mindedness has been remarkable to watch. He does seem at some level to believe that if he just keeps saying, we're going to get this done, we're going to do this, we're going to put people on the record, that those who have publicly registered objections will just fade away, that it's somehow all for show. And it's not. And so in the last 6 weeks alone, we have seen Schumer promise that he would bring up Build Back Better for a vote. We've seen him promise that it would be passed by the end of the year. We have seen him promise that he would pass these voting bills. And then when it became clear that he couldn't, we've seen him rush ahead anyway and say it was important to get Democrats on the record. Well, in fact, I think it was important not to get them on the record. Mark Kelly in Arizona has been hiding behind Kyrsten Sinema for a year. In order to be reelected, Mark Kelly probably needs to hide behind Kyrsten Sinema and not put himself in any difficult or politically disadvantageous positions. And Schumer forced him 2 days ago to take a vote. And the same is arguably true of Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, who seems to be in trouble, of Cortez Masto in Nevada, who seems to be in trouble, of the Reverend Raphael Warnock in Georgia, who may be in trouble. It's too early to tell. You know, across the country, there are Democrats in states that come a red wave will not be particularly secure. And Chuck Schumer just handed his opponents a cudgel with which to beat those Democratic candidates, but also did so without getting anything out of it, at least anything concrete. And I just think that it was a profound mistake, and it shows a tactical naivety.
So, Maddie, exit question to you. We have these Biden polls. He's probably low 40s. We had a Quinnipiac poll that was an outlier. I had him, I think, at 33, if I remember correctly. Had a couple, including Gallup, that had him right at 40. And then there have been a few others this week that have him, you know, 42, 43. But there's an astonishing poll. I guess came out yesterday. I forget who did it, but it asked whether Biden should run again, and only like 30% of the public thinks he should run again, 70% think he shouldn't. And only 48% of Democrats think at this juncture, should he run again? So extra question to you, will Joe Biden run again? Yes or no?
I'm going to say no.
MBD.
Only if Trump is running, he'll run again.
So he'll wait to see whether Trump makes the plunge?
Yeah, I think so.
Charlie Cook?
I think he will, because I think the alternatives will be unthinkable to the Democrats. Those alternatives are Kamala Harris takes over because Joe Biden resigns or steps aside, or there is a primary election while he's president. We know what happens when parties hold primary elections while they hold the White House. They lose. It's what happened in 1980 after Jimmy Carter was assailed by Ted Kennedy while Jimmy Carter was trying to be president. And it's what happened in 1992 when Patrick Buchanan assailed George H.W. Bush while George H.W. Bush was trying to be president. I understand that pundits love these West Wing style scenarios and machinations. I just can't see the Democrats going for it in practice.
I take all his points. I just think he's not going to be able to do it. I think it's going to be kind of obvious that he's just not up for the job by then. So I'm also going to say no. With that, let me do a quick NR Plus plug. Digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our increasingly extensive paywall. Your way to, if you sign up for NR Plus and actually log in, you got to log into the website to see basically no ads. Your way to comment on blog posts and articles if that floats your boat, to be part of a private Facebook group if you want to, and to join exclusive conversations and events with conservative newsmakers and with our writers and editors. I had a call with Mike Pompeo for our NR Plus subscribers. That was a lot of fun, a great success just the last couple of days. And MBD and Phil Klein, right, MBD, coming up sometime soon here, are going to do a Zoom with NR Plus subscribers talking about COVID and COVID policy. So it's a great deal, a great way to plug in deeper to the NR Plus community. Great first-time deals running at any given moment. So please check it out. So Maddie, we got something going on in the UK that I have a little trouble wrapping my head around. It's just, I find it hard to believe that the political leader of like a major Western country may be deposed because of a couple garden parties, but it looks as though that could happen to Boris Johnson. I guess someone should have predicted a while ago that if Johnson ever went down, it would have something to do with a social event or something along those lines. But there are these parties, or I guess, I don't know, alleged parties. I guess there's a debate now about what constitutes a party that went on at the time of the extreme lockdowns and restrictions in the UK. They were at outdoor garden parties, which would seem to be fine in my view, but there were restrictions at that time about how large a outdoor party could be. And Boris, you know, usually ebullient, jokey, has been evasive and kind of legalistic in his defenses here. What's going on?
Yeah, so I think there's two things to understand. The first is what's happening within the Tory party itself. And this is always the case with the Conservative Party in the UK, that they are fiercely loyal until they're not. So the age-old example is, of course, Margaret Thatcher, who, having delivered three election victories in a row, was then got rid of because of the combination of poor polling and a major political mistake in the introduction of the poll tax. And that combination meant that Tory MPs started to worry about their own re-election and thought that she was the person to pin all the failings on and just better to get rid of her. The Conservatives are having a similar discussion internally just now about Boris Johnson. He has, of course, made enemies through Brexit and various other things, but it really comes down to people thinking, is he going to cause us our seats in the next election? So there's the reason I think that the British public, because Boris Johnson is doing terribly in the polls now as a result of these, as the result of Partygate, as it's been being called. I think the reason the British public are so angry about it is because, as you mentioned, we in the UK were under really, really, really strict lockdowns all throughout 2020 and well into 2021. And if there's one thing the British public hate, it's hypocrisy, one standard for the elite and a different standard for everybody else. They really, really don't like that. So the optics of it aren't great because people were foregoing visits to family members, even dying family members, and all sorts of heartbreaking scenarios. And Boris Johnson was involved in various social gatherings that broke his own rules. What's happening right now is there's an investigation underway as to the extent to which these rules were broken. And this investigation is by a woman called Sue Gray, who's an independent civil servant. And many people are waiting for the results of that, many Conservative MPs, before they decide whether or not to trigger a leadership contest. But I actually find it strange in a way that people are so angry with Boris Johnson, because actually the strange thing about what happened in the UK was that the lockdowns were really popular. The vast majority of the public wanted such strict rules. And I kind of wonder if what's happening here is that with hindsight, people regret that they missed their family member's wedding. They regret that they weren't allowed to say goodbye to a loved one. They have all this feeling of, do you know what, maybe this wasn't proportionate. Maybe it wasn't worth it. My child's education has been massively interrupted. And in a way, it's just easier to have this scapegoat. And he's not entirely innocent. Boris Johnson almost definitely is guilty of hypocrisy. And he also did introduce those rules. But of course, politicians do what their voters want them to do. And so that's why we had such strict rules. So it's strange. I do think that he's really under serious risk of being booted out here, because if the results of this report come back as really, really clear cut that he broke his own rules, then I think the public anger will be
Don't tip your hand. That's my exit question. Don't tip your hand. It's a little bit tip, but maybe not fully tip. So MBD, yeah. This just strikes me as one of those cases. And I often think this about things here in the U.S. as well. When someone says something, you know, genuinely offensive, it's just, why wouldn't an apology be sufficient? And I don't mean these, you know, groveling Mao era style self-abasing apologies and that are not part of our national life here. But just like, I shouldn't have said it, you know, my bad. You know, why can't Boris just say, okay, I went to the party. You know, I'm a human being. I regret it. I understand why everyone's so upset. But obviously, you know, people have been really upset here with instances of COVID hypocrisy. And Andrew Studdiford has a good piece that's about to go up on the website, making the case that this kind of anger is enhanced in the UK because there's this real ethic, you know, going back decades, including most importantly, World War II, where everyone just has a sense that we're going to pitch into this together and everyone has to do their bit. And Andrew makes the point, the royal family has always been highly cognizant of this and taking symbolic measures to indicate that they are going through at least some form what the rest of the public does and what Boris did here kind of trespassed that public ethic.
Yeah, that is all correct. You know, I think Boris Johnson has tried apologizing. The problem is that you apologize once and then somebody who's turned against you leaks another instance where the same thing happened, right? Like this is multiple parties now. And so it's like, how many times can you go to the public and apologize for the same thing? Like, it's almost like a kind of recidivism of, but in the past, that we need a word for this, where you apologize once for your exposed misdeed and then more previous to the apology are exposed. That's the trouble he's in. And I do think Maddie is right that a lot of this is a kind of almost like natural scapegoating effect, where people are pretending that the government out of nowhere imposed lockdowns, not that they were popular. Now that many people regret lockdown as a policy or question whether it had the efficacy that the kind of efficacy that could justify such a policy, if anything could. So he's in trouble. I don't find the offenses all that offensive, right? I mean, you know, there's a couple of incriminating details, like, oh, the invitation said bring your own bottle or something like that. So it looks like, well, that's clearly not just a work meeting.
Wow.
Well, that's right. For most people, Charlie, outside of editorial operations, don't have that kind of latitude. But I don't find them that offensive as events. You know, this isn't like, you know, that Hungarian minister of culture that was like caught in an orgy in Brussels or whatever. Like, you know, when he's
bit of a low bar, though, I think.
I don't know. In British politics, I'm not so sure when you dive into Asquith's history or something like that. But anyway, I don't find it all that offensive. And the other thing is, I think Johnson is in trouble with the Tory party because of other things. It's not just the lockdowns and the hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. It's really that... what's conservative about him? He's kind of pitched himself as this green conservative, and his constituency seems to be his wife and her friends. And it seems completely irrelevant to the Tories either holding on to their threatened territory in the Southeast or holding on to all the territory they took from Labour in the Red Wall. I think what we've come to discover is the obvious solution is for Boris to have an affair with a fetching Sunderland fan and begin repairing the damage that way before moving on to a Scott and maybe a Sinn Feiner to keep the union together.
So Charlie, that gets to a question I was going to ask you, not about what affairs Boris should have, but so what happened? He was, you know, last time we discussed Boris on this podcast, probably was, you know, he effectuates Brexit after his predecessor is just stymied by this deadlock and Parliament wins this election that seems to point the way forward to, you know, a new, more perhaps more powerful Tory coalition. And then we tune back in and everyone hates him and he's hanging on for his life.
Well, I think there are a few things. The first is that if you are in charge while coronavirus is disrupting your life, you seem eventually to become unpopular. This was true of Donald Trump. It's true of Joe Biden, and it's true of Boris Johnson as well. I don't think that is his fault. Certainly, though, if you throw in some hypocrisy, as Maddie outlined, it's going to get even worse. And the only thing I would add to Maddie's answer, which I thought was terrific, is that the original sin in Britain is class. In America, it's race. And Boris had been given something of a pass because he was seen as a toff, an upper class Bertie Wooster type, but a man of the people as well. I suspect this is one reason he likes Churchill so much, because Churchill managed to pull off this trick. Of course, that can change pretty quickly if you misbehave and if you set different rules for yourself than you would expect of others. And now I think his foppishness and his famous mannerisms are working against him, because people say, oh, he's just another Etonian parliamentarian who thinks he can get away with anything. The second issue for Boris is that the coalition that the Tories put together at the last election was fruitful for them in terms of adding seats to their majority, but also provided something of a challenge in that it was there primarily as a mandate to get Brexit done. And Brexit is now done. And the coalition for Brexit was not the same thing as the coalition for the Conservatives. Brexit commanded just about majority support. But the reasons people supported Brexit varied wildly by class, by region, by political outlook. And as with the American Revolution, the moment it was achieved, there was a great deal of fighting as to what the future should look like. And the Tories were not particularly well set up to answer the questions that arose. The British electorate is something of a Rubik's Cube in this sense. You try and placate northern constituents who historically do not vote for the Tory party, and you upset Middle England. You pursue an agenda that is geared at Middle England, which is the traditional Tory approach, and you lose those you've just brought in to the fold. If you add in COVID to that, I think you have a recipe for disaster that has been made worse by the fact that Boris Johnson does not seem to be a particularly good leader. I'm sure he is devastated by this because he spent his whole life trying to be one. He thought he was destined for the premiership. But oddly enough, like his hero, Winston Churchill, he really does seem to have been put on earth to do one thing. And that one thing was get Brexit done. Brexit's done. Brexit's done, and now he's flailing. And Maddie is absolutely correct when she says that while Conservatives, I'm sure, are annoyed by the stories from this drinks party, the Tory party is extraordinarily ruthless and cares about maintaining power, which it's very good at. The Labour Party has won only two elections outright since 1975. And as such, you should see a lot of the maneuvering that's being done as an attempt to get rid of an unpopular leader rather than any real concern over the proximate cause.
So, Maddie Kearns, as a forecast, exit question to you, will Boris Johnson survive? Yes or no?
I think no, but I think it's going to take some time. I think we're going to have the report. It's going to be bad, but not damningly bad. But then there's going to be more revelations later. Because if you think of the way that these bombshells have been staggered, it's very deliberate. So Dominic Cummings, who was a former advisor, I think he has more up his sleeve. And I think it's going to get to the point where it becomes impossible for him to hang on. But I do think he could be around till the summer.
I think he's going to survive. I think we're close enough now to the end of COVID and the, just this week he declared that the government is going to cease most of the restrictions heading forward. And I think once that gets going and once people are going out into the street and going about rebuilding the routines of conviviality in their life, that's an environment Johnson can thrive in again. And there's enough time before the next election. And really, who do the Tories have to replace him? I don't see anyone who's going to look like as much of a winner as he is.
Should I cook?
I think he's going to go.
Ooh, I'm alone.
On Maddie, kind of Maddie terms, a little stretched out.
I think that this has passed the point of no return, irrespective of whether it should have. He's now wounded in the eyes of the public. And if you combine that with the mistakes that led to him being wounded, I think it's untenable.
So I really have no idea. People I've checked in with say, you know, it's kind of a 50-50 proposition or maybe 51-49 with Boris surviving. But I'm going to go with Maddie and Charlie. I assume the report will be damning on a certain level. And He's a wounded duck, and he is on his way out. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. So, Maddie, for fun, you visited the Edinburgh Dungeon.
Yes.
And so you're over in Scotland, we should stipulate.
Yes, I am over in Scotland, and there are many wonderful
Wasn't Edinburgh, Kentucky, or where? There must be an Edinburgh somewhere in the U.S.
I'm sure there is. There are many, many things, worthwhile things to do in Edinburgh. Many historical sites. There's a castle. There's various preserved streets from the 1600s. But there is also this gimmicky tourist attraction called the Edinburgh Dungeon, and it's just so much fun. And I'd forgotten how much fun it was, actually, because they have actors dress up as historical characters and actually kind of shout at you and insult you, but in a very funny way. And I was, in fact, convicted of witchcraft during this tour of the dungeon. Luckily, did not perish in flames, survived. But it's just really, really good fun and a good laugh. So if you're ever in Edinburgh, I recommend it.
MBD, you've been listening to the Queens of the Stone Age.
Yes. So just going through my own music box, and this was a week where a little frustrated and I wanted to listen to some hard rock. And I'm just a big fan of Queens of the Stone Age, which is a band that kind of began out of Palm Desert, California. And I don't know, just digging deeper into their tracks, they've kind of got this sludgy stoner rock sound, and they're a blast to listen to when you feel trapped inside.
And Charlie, you've been watching the TV show Around the World in 80 Days?
I have. This is a British and French production starring David Tennant, who I think I talked about before with Einstein and Eddington. And it was just enormous fun. I don't think it's particularly faithful to the book, although I don't know because I haven't actually read the book. But it didn't matter. It's 8 episodes. It's produced by Ashley Farrow, who produced both Ashes to Ashes and Life on Mars, which I thought were terrific series. Music's by Hans Zimmer, and it just zips along. And to show you how unfaithful to the book it is, they are producing a second series at the moment, which I'm greatly looking forward to.
So I got some business to transact. First, I have to ask an exit question of myself. Rich, how many yards will Derrick Henry gain in the playoff game against the Bengals on Saturday afternoon? 120 yards. Mark it down, 120 yards with Deontay Foreman pitching in for a pretty good day himself, enough to get the Titans over the Bengals and what in Titan terms would be a comfortable victory of 24-20. You heard it here first. Also, shout out to Zan's friend and text correspondent who texted Zan about my light item last week about getting the bigger squirrel buster bird feeder. And she said, as she listened to me discussing this, she was at that very moment in an amazing coincidence that a sign of the kind of magic woven by this podcast was refilling her own massive squirrel buster bird feeder. So whoever you are, I feel the connection and just want to let you know that and appreciate Kevin, who's reached out to Sarah and me about trying to get us together to on a road trip to go to Southeast Pennsylvania to see geese migrate. So Sarah, are we going to do this? Is this going to happen? I think probably not, but
I doubt it. Geese are, yeah, I like birds, but
wow.
Geese.
So my light item is I've been reading this book by this archaeologist and historian named Ian Morris. It's quite incredible. It's called The Why the West Rules For Now. And it's really a history of all of civilization, Western and Eastern, making the case that actually we're kind of miscued by the last 300 years or so to just think that the West is inexorably going to be on a higher level of development than the East. He goes through all of history and says, actually, it's gone up and down and will go up and down again. So the West, even though it rules for now, won't forever. I take that argument, although he's much too much a materialist for my taste, and seems to always find an excuse for the disastrous decisions that Chinese society and leadership made that allowed the West to sprint so far ahead. So with that, it's time in this podcast for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick is a piece by Charlie Cook. It's Biden's Year of Failure, reflecting on 1 year of Biden administration and its total lack of achievement to address itself to the problems that people in the United States think we have. And instead, it's in its own self-obsessions and senility, and we're all the worse off for it. Thank you, Charlie.
Maddie Kearns, what's your pick?
My pick is Isaac Shore's The Media's Muted Reaction to Biden Casting Doubt on Election Legitimacy, which is quite a long title, I realize, in reading that out. But just a really great rundown of that particular debacle and some really sharp analysis.
Charlie, what's your pick?
My pick is Dominic Pino in general. I remain in awe of Dominic and give him any topic. Hey, why do we have a problem with train robberies? And then you get this fantastic and useful explanation. And just yesterday, he, and I'm aware that I'm speaking against interest here, he managed to parse Joe Manchin's latest comments in mere seconds. It takes me hours sitting there with the tea leaves and goat entrails. But Dominic saw the consequences of what Joe Manchin had said, threw them up on the corner, and I think deserves some congratulations for it.
So my pick is a magazine piece by Barry Latzer, who's written for us a lot over the years on criminal justice matters, pushing back on the progressive narratives about prison and policing and all the rest of it. And this is just a comprehensive slam of the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a Nash Review podcast. Any rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of Nash Review Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Maddie. Thank you, MBD. Thanks, Tommy John. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.